10. Atticus was feeble. He was nearly 50. When Jim and I asked him why he was so old, he said he got started late, which we felt reflected upon his abilities and manliness. He was much older than the parents of our school contemporaries, and there was nothing Jim or I could say about him when our classmates said, "My father..." Jim was football crazy. Atticus was never too tired to play keep away, but when Jim wanted to tackle him, Atticus would say, "I'm too old for that, son." Our father didn't do anything. He worked in an office, not in a drugstore. Atticus did not drive a dump truck for the county. He was not the sheriff. He did not farm, work in a garage, or do anything that could possibly arouse the admiration of anyone. Besides that, he wore glasses. He was nearly blind in his left eye and said left eyes were the tribal curse of the Finches. Whenever he wanted to see something well, he turned his head and looked from his right eye. He did not do the things our schoolmates' fathers did. He never went hunting. He did not play poker or fish or drink or smoke. He sat in the living room and read. With these attributes, however, he would not remain as inconspicuous as we wished him to. That year, the school buzzed with talk about him defending Tom Robinson, none of which was complimentary. After my bout with Cecil Jacobs, when I committed myself to a policy of cowardice, word got around that Scout Finch wouldn't fight anymore. Her daddy wouldn't let her. This was not entirely correct. I wouldn't fight publicly for Atticus, but the family was private ground. I would fight anyone from a third cousin upwards, tooth and nail. Francis Hancock, for example, knew that. When he gave us our air rifles, Atticus wouldn't teach us to shoot. Uncle Jack instructed us in the rudiments thereof. He said Atticus wasn't interested in guns. Atticus said to Jim one day, "I'd rather you shot at tin cans in the backyard, but I know you'll go after birds. Shoot all the blue jays you want, if you can hit 'em, but remember, it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." That was the only time I ever heard Atticus say it was a sin to do something, and I asked Miss Maudie about it. "Your father's right," she said. "Mockingbirds don't do one thing but make music for us to enjoy. They don't eat up people's gardens, don't nest in corn cribs. They don't do one thing but sing their hearts out for us. That's why it's a sin to kill a mockingbird." "Miss Maudie, this is an old neighborhood, ain't it?" "Been here longer than the town." "No'm, I mean the folks on our street are all old. Jim and me's the only children around here. Mrs. DeBose is close on to 100, and Miss Rachel's old, and so are you and Atticus." "I don't call 50 very old," said Miss Maudie tartly. "Not being wheeled around yet, am I? Neither's your father. But I must say Providence was kind enough to burn down that old mausoleum of mine. I'm too old to keep it up. Maybe you're right, Jean Louise. This is a settled neighborhood. You've never been around young folks much, have you?"
"Yes'm, at school."
"I mean young grown-ups. You're lucky, you know. You and Jim have the benefit of your father's age. If your father was 30, you'd find life quite different."
"I sure would. Atticus can't do anything."
"You'd be surprised," said Miss Maudie. "There's life in him yet."
"What can he do?"
"Well, he can make somebody's will so airtight can't anybody meddle with it."
"Shoot."
"Well, did you know he's the best checker player in this town? Why, down at the landing, when we were coming up, Atticus Finch could beat everybody on both sides of the river."
"Good Lord, Miss Maudie, Jim and me beat him all the time."
It's about time you found out it's because he lets you. Did you know he can play a jew's harp? This modest accomplishment served to make me even more ashamed of him.
Well, she said.
Well, what, Miss Maudie?
Well, nothing.
Nothing. It seems with all that you'd be proud of him. Can't everybody play a jew's harp. Now keep out of the way of the carpenters. You better go home. I'll be in my azaleas and can't watch you. Plank might hit you. I went to the backyard and found Jim plugging away at a tin can, which seemed stupid with all the blue jays around. I returned to the front yard and busied myself for 2 hours erecting a complicated breastworks at the side of the porch, consisting of a tire, an orange crate, the laundry hamper, the porch chairs, and a small U.S. flag Jim gave me from a popcorn box. When Atticus came home to dinner, he found me crouched down, aiming across the street.
What are you shooting at?
Miss Maudie's rear end? Atticus turned and saw my generous target bending over her bushes. He pushed his hat to the back of his head and crossed the street.
Maudie, he called, I thought I'd better warn you. You're in considerable peril.
Miss Maudie straightened up and looked toward me. She said,
Atticus, you are a devil from hell.
When Atticus returned, he told me to break camp. Don't you ever let me catch you pointing that gun at anybody again, he said. I wished my father was a devil from hell. I sounded out Calpurnia on the subject.
Mr. Finch? Why, he can do lots of things.
Like what? I asked. Calpurnia scratched her head.
Well, I don't rightly know, she said.
Jim underlined it when he asked Atticus if he was going out for the Methodist, and Atticus said he'd break his neck if he did. He was just too old for that sort of thing. The Methodists were trying to pay off their church mortgage and had challenged the Baptists to a game of touch football. Everybody in town's father was playing, it seemed, except Atticus. Jim said he didn't even want to go, but he was unable to resist football in any form, and he stood gloomily on the sidelines with Atticus and me, watching Cecil Jacob's father make touchdowns for the Baptists. One Saturday, Jim and I decided to go exploring with our air rifles to see if we could find a rabbit or a squirrel. We had gone about 500 yards beyond the Radley place when I noticed Jim squinting at something down the street. He had turned his head to one side and was looking out of the corners of his eyes.
What you looking at?
That old dog down yonder, he said. That's old Tim Johnson, ain't it?
Yeah.
Tim Johnson was the property of Mr. Harry Johnson, who drove the Mobile bus and lived on the southern edge of town. Tim was a liver-colored bird dog, the pet of Makem.
What's he doing?
I don't know, Scout. We better go home.
Oh, Jim, it's February.
I don't care. I'm going to tell Cal. We raced home and ran to the kitchen.
Cal, said Jim. Can you come down the sidewalk a minute?
What for, Jim? I can't come down the sidewalk every time you want me. There's something wrong with an old dog down yonder. Calpurnia sighed. I can't wrap up any dog's foot now. There's some gauze in the bathroom. Go get it and do it yourself. Jim shook his head. He's sick, Cal. Something's wrong with him.
What's he doing, trying to catch his tail?
No, he's doing like this. Jim gulped like a goldfish, hunched his shoulders, and twitched his torso. He's going like that, only not like he means to.
Are you telling me a story, Jim Finch? Calpurnia's voice hardened.
No, Cal, I swear I'm not.
Was he running?
No, he's just moseying along so slow you can't hardly tell it. He's coming this way. Calpurnia rinsed her hands and followed Jim into the yard.
I don't see any dog, she said. She followed us beyond the Radley place and looked where Jim pointed. Tim Johnson was not much more than a speck in the distance, but he was closer to us. He walked erratically, as if his right legs were shorter than his left legs. He reminded me of a car stuck in a sandbed. He's gone lopsided, said Jim. Calpurnia stared, then grabbed us by the shoulders and ran us home. She shut the wood door behind us, went to the telephone, and shouted, "Gimme Mr. Finch's office!" "Mr. Finch," she shouted, "this is Cal. I swear to God there's a mad dog down the street a piece. He's coming this way. Yes, sir, he's... Mr. Finch, I declare he is old Tim Johnson. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Yes." She hung up and shook her head when we tried to ask her what Atticus had said. She rattled the telephone hook and said, "Miss Eula May? Now, ma'am, I'm through talking to Mr. Finch. Please don't connect me no more. Listen, Miss Eula May, can you call Miss Rachel and Miss Stephanie Crawford and whoever's got a phone on this street and tell them a mad dog's coming? Please, ma'am." Calpurnia listened. "I know it's February, Miss Eula May, but I know a mad dog when I see one. Please, ma'am, hurry." Calpurnia asked Jim, "Radley's got a phone?" Jim looked in the book and said, "No. They won't come out anyway, Cal." "I don't care. I'm going to tell them." She ran to the front porch, Jim and I at her heels. "You stay in that house," she yelled. Calpurnia's message had been received by the neighborhood. Every wood door within our range of vision was closed tight. We saw no trace of Tim Johnson. We watched Calpurnia running toward the Radley place, holding her skirt and apron above her knees. She went up to the front steps and banged on the door. She got no answer, and she shouted, "Mr. Nathan! Mr. Arthur! Mad dog's coming! Mad dog's coming!" "She's supposed to go around in back," I said. Jim shook his head. "Don't make any difference now," he said. Calpurnia pounded on the door in vain. No one acknowledged her warning. No one seemed to have heard it. As Calpurnia sprinted to the back porch, a black Ford swung into the driveway. Atticus and Mr. Heck Tate got out. Mr. Heck Tate was the sheriff of Macomb County. He was as tall as Atticus, but thinner. He was long-nosed, wore boots with shiny metal eye holes, boot pants, and a lumber jacket. His belt had a row of bullets sticking in it. He carried a heavy rifle. When he and Atticus reached the porch, Jim opened the door.
"Stay inside, son," said Atticus. "Where is he, Cal?"
"He ought to be here by now," said Calpurnia, pointing down the street.
"Not running, is he?" asked Mr. Tate.
"No, sir. He's in the twitching stage, Mr. Heck."
"Should we go after him, Heck?" asked Atticus. "We better wait, Mr. Finch. They usually go in a straight line, but you never can tell. He might follow the curve. Hope he does, or he'll go straight in the Radley backyard. Let's wait a minute." "Don't think he'll get in the Radley yard," said Atticus. "Fence'll stop him. He'll probably follow the road."
I thought mad dogs foamed at the mouth, galloped, leaped, and lunged at throats, and I thought they did it in August. Had Tim Johnson behaved thus, I would have been less frightened. Nothing is more deadly than a deserted, waiting street. The trees were still. The mockingbirds were silent. The carpenters at Miss Maudie's house had vanished. I heard Mr. Tate sniff, then blow his nose. I saw him shift his gun to the crook of his arm. I saw Miss Stephanie Crawford's face framed in the glass window of her front door. Miss Maudie appeared and stood beside her. Atticus put his foot on the rung of a chair
and rubbed his hand slowly down the side of his thigh. "There he is," he said softly. Tim Johnson came into sight, walking dazedly in the inner rim of the curve parallel to the Radley house. "Look at him," whispered Jim. "Mr. Heck said they walked in a straight line. He can't even stay in the road."
"He looks more sick than anything," I said. "Let anything get in front of him and he'll come straight at it."
Mr. Tate put his hand to his forehead and leaned forward.
"He's got it all right, Mr. Finch."
Tim Johnson was advancing at a snail's pace, but he was not playing or sniffing at foliage. He seemed dedicated to one course and motivated by an invisible force that was inching him toward us. We could see him shiver like a horse shedding flies. His jaw opened and shut. He was a list, but he was being pulled gradually toward us. "He's looking for a place to die," said Jim. Mr. Tate turned around. "He's far from dead, Jim. He hasn't got started yet." Tim Johnson reached the side street that ran in front of the Radley place, and what remained of his poor mind made him pause and seem to consider which road he would take. He made a few hesitant steps and stopped in front of the Radley gate. Then he tried to turn around, but was having difficulty. Atticus said, "He's within range, Heck. You better get him now before he goes down the side street. Lord knows who's around the corner. Go inside, Cal." Calpurnia opened the screen door, latched it behind her, then unlatched it and held onto the hook. She tried to block Jim and me with her body, but we looked out from beneath her arms. "Take him, Mr. Finch." Mr. Tate handed the rifle to Atticus. "Jim and I nearly fainted." "Don't waste time, Heck," said Atticus. "Go on." "Mr. Finch, this is a one-shot job." Atticus shook his head vehemently. "Don't just stand there, Heck. He won't wait all day for you."
"For God's sake, Mr. Finch, look where he is. Miss, and you'll go straight into the Radley house. I can't shoot that well, and you know it."
"I haven't shot a gun in 30 years.
Mr. Tate almost threw the rifle at Atticus.
"I'd feel mighty comfortable if you did now," he said.
In a fog, Jim and I watched our father take the gun and walk out into the middle of the street. He walked quickly, but I thought he moved like an underwater swimmer. Time had slowed to a nauseating crawl. When Atticus raised his glasses, Calpurnia murmured, "Sweet Jesus, help him," and put her hands to her cheeks. Atticus pushed his glasses to his forehead. They slipped down, and he dropped them in the street. In the silence, I heard them crack. Atticus rubbed his eyes and chin. We saw him blink hard. In front of the Radley gate, Tim Johnson had made up what was left of his mind. He had finally turned himself around to pursue his original course up our street. He made 2 steps forward, then stopped and raised his head. We saw his body go rigid. With movements so swift they seemed simultaneous, Atticus's hand yanked a ball-tipped lever as he brought the gun to his shoulder. The rifle cracked. Tim Johnson leaped, flopped over, and crumpled on the sidewalk in a brown and white heap. He didn't know what hit him. Mr. Tate jumped off the porch and ran to the Radley place. He stopped in front of the dog, squatted, turned around, and tapped his finger on his forehead above his left eye.
"You were a little to the right, Mr. Finch," he called.
"Always was," answered Atticus. "If I had my druthers, I'd take a shotgun."
He stooped and picked up his glasses, ground the broken lenses to powder under his heel, and went to Mr. Tate and stood looking down at Tim Johnson. Doors opened one by one, and the neighborhood slowly came alive. Miss Maudie walked down the steps with Miss Stephanie Crawford. Jim was paralyzed. I pinched him to get him moving, but when Atticus saw us coming, he called, "Stay where you are." When Mr. Tate and Atticus returned to the yard, Mr. Tate was smiling. "I'll have Zebo collect him," he said. "You haven't forgotten much, Mr. Finch. They say it never leaves you." Atticus was silent. "Atticus?" said Jim. "Yes." "Nothing." "I saw that one shot, Finch." Atticus wheeled and faced Miss Maudie. They looked at one another without saying anything, and Atticus got into the sheriff's car. "Come here," he said to Jim. "Don't you go near that dog, you understand? Don't go near him. He's just as dangerous dead as alive." "Yes, sir," said Jim. "Atticus?"
"What, son?"
"Nothing."
"What's the matter with you, boy? Can't you talk?" said Mr. Tate, grinning at Jim. "Didn't you know your daddy's—"
"Hush, heck," said Atticus. "Let's go back to town." When they drove away, Jim and I went to Miss Stephanie's front steps. We sat waiting for Zebo to arrive in the garbage truck. Jim sat in numb confusion, and Miss Stephanie said, "Mm-mm-mm, who'd have thought of a mad dog in February? Maybe he wasn't mad. Maybe he was just crazy. I'd hate to see Harry Johnson's face when he gets in from the Mobile run and finds Atticus Finch has shot his dog. But he was just full of fleas from somewhere." Miss Maudie said Miss Stephanie'd be singing a different tune if Tim Johnson was still coming up the street. That they'd find out soon enough. They'd send his head to Montgomery. Jim became vaguely articulate. "D'you see him, Scout? D'you see him just standing there? And all of a sudden he just relaxed all over, and it looked like that gun was a part of him. And he did it so quick-like. I have to aim for 10 minutes before I can hit something." Miss Maudie grinned wickedly. "Well, now, Miss Jean Louise," she said, "still think your father can't do anything? Still ashamed of him?"
"No'm," I said meekly.
"Forgot to tell you the other day that besides playing the jew's harp, Atticus Finch was the deadest shot in Macomb County in his time."
"Dead shot," echoed Jim.
"That what I said, Jim Finch. Guess you'll change your tune now." "The very idea. Didn't you know his nickname was Old One Shot when he was a boy? Why, down at the landing when he was coming up, if he shot 15 times and hit 14 does, he'd complain about wasting ammunition."
"He never said anything about that," Jim muttered.
"Never said anything about it, did he?"
"No, ma'am."
"Wonder why he never goes hunting now," I said.
"Maybe I can tell you," said Miss Maudie. "If your father's anything, he's civilized in his heart. Marksmanship's a gift of God, a talent. Oh, you have to practice to make it perfect, but shooting's different from playing the piano or the like. I think maybe he put his gun down when he realized that God had given him an unfair advantage over most living things. I guess he decided he wouldn't shoot till he had to, and he had to today."
"Looks like he'd be proud of it," I said.
"People in their right minds never take pride in their talents," said Miss Maudie.
We saw Zebo drive up. He took a pitchfork from the back of the garbage truck and gingerly lifted Tim Johnson. He pitched the dog onto the truck, then poured something from a gallon jug on and around the spot where Tim fell. "Don't y'all come over here for a while," he called. When we went home, I told Jim we'd really have something to talk about at school on Monday. Jim turned on me. "Don't say anything about it, Scout," he said.
What? I certainly am. Ain't everybody's daddy the deadest shot in Macomb County?
Jim said.
I reckon if he wanted us to know it, he'd have told us. If he was proud of it, he'd have told us.
Maybe it just slipped his mind, I said.
Nah, Scout, it's something you wouldn't understand. Atticus is real old, but I wouldn't care if he couldn't do anything. I wouldn't care if he couldn't do a blessed thing.
Jim picked up a rock and threw it jubilantly at the car house. Running after it, he called back.
Atticus is a gentleman, just like me.
11. When we were small, Jim and I confined our activities to the southern neighborhood. But when I was well into the second grade at school, and tormenting Boo Radley became passé, the business section of Macomb drew us frequently up the street past the real property of Mrs. Henry Lafayette DeBose. It was impossible to go to town without passing her house, unless we wished to walk a mile out of the way. Previous minor encounters with her left me with no desire for more, but Jim said I had to grow up sometime. Mrs. DeBose lived alone, except for a Negro girl in constant attendance. Two doors up the street from us, and a house with steep front steps and a dog-trot hall. She was very old. She spent most of each day in bed, and the rest of it in a wheelchair. It was rumored that she kept a CSA pistol concealed among her numerous shawls and wraps. Jim and I hated her. If she was on the porch when we passed, we would be raked by her wrathful gaze, subjected to ruthless interrogation regarding our behavior, and given a melancholy prediction on what we would amount to when we grew up, which was always nothing. We had long ago given up the idea of walking past her house on the opposite side of the street. That only made her raise her voice and let the whole neighborhood in on it. We could do nothing to please her. If I said as sunnily as I could, "Hey, Mrs. DeBose," I would receive for an answer, "Don't you say hey to me, you ugly girl. You say good afternoon, Mrs. DeBose." She was vicious. Once she heard Jim refer to our father as Atticus, and her reaction was apoplectic. Besides being the sassiest, most disrespectful mutts who ever passed her way, we were told that it was quite a pity our father had not remarried after our mother's death. A lovelier lady than our mother never lived, she said, and it was heartbreaking the way Atticus Finch let her children run wild. I did not remember our mother, but Jim did. He would tell me about her sometimes, and he went livid when Mrs. DeBose shot us this message. Jim, having survived Boo Radley, a mad dog, and other terrors, and concluded that it was cowardly to stop at Miss Rachel's front steps and wait, and had decreed that we must run as far as the post office corner each evening to meet Atticus coming from work. Countless evenings Atticus would find Jim furious at something Mrs. DeBose had said when we went by. "Easy does it, son," Atticus would say. "She's an old lady, and she's ill. You just hold your head high and be a gentleman. Whatever she says to you, it's your job not to let her make you mad." Jim would say she must not be very sick, she hollered so. When the three of us came to her house, Atticus would sweep off his hat, wave gallantly to her, and say, "Good evening, Mrs. DeBose. You look like a picture this evening." I never heard Atticus say like a picture of what. He would tell her the courthouse news and would say he hoped with all his heart she'd have a good day tomorrow. He would return his hat to his head, swing me to his shoulders in her very presence, and we would go home in the twilight. It was times like these when I thought my father, who hated guns and had never been to any wars, was the bravest man who ever lived. The day after Jim's 12th birthday, his money was burning up his pockets, so we headed for town in the early afternoon. Jim thought he had enough to buy a miniature steam engine for himself and a twirling baton for me. I had long had my eye on that baton. It was at V.J. Elmore's. It was bedecked with sequins and tinsel. It cost 17 cents. It was then my burning ambition to grow up and twirl with the Macomb County High School Band. Having developed my talent to where I could throw up a stick and almost catch it coming down, I had caused Calpurnia to deny me entrance to the house every time she saw me with a stick in my hand. I felt that I could overcome this defect with a real baton, and I thought it generous of Jim to buy one for me. Mrs. DeBose was stationed on her porch when we went by. "Where are you two going at this time of day?" she shouted. "Playing hooky, I suppose. I'll just call up the principal and tell him." She put her hands on the wheels of her chair and executed a perfect right face.
"It's Saturday, Mrs. DeBose," said Jim.
"Makes no difference if it's Saturday," she said obscurely. "I wonder if your father knows where you are."
"Mrs. DeBose, we've been going to town by ourselves since we were this high."
Jim placed his hand, palm down, about 2 feet above the sidewalk. "Don't you lie to me," she yelled. "Jeremy Finch, Maudie Atkinson told me you broke down her scuppernong arbor this morning. She's going to tell your father, and then you'll wish you never saw the light of day. If you aren't sent to the reform school before next week, my name's not DeBose."
Jim, who hadn't been near Miss Maudie's scuppernong arbor since last summer, and who knew Miss Maudie wouldn't tell Atticus if he had, issued a general denial.
"Don't you contradict me," Mrs. DeBose bawled. "And you," she pointed an arthritic finger at me, "what are you doing in those overalls? You should be in a dress and camisole, young lady. You'll grow up waiting on tables if somebody doesn't change your ways. A Finch waiting on tables at the O.K. Cafe. Ha!"
I was terrified. The O.K. Cafe was a dim organization on the north side of the square. I grabbed Jim's hand, but he shook me loose. "Come on, Scout," he whispered. "Don't pay any attention to her. Just hold your head high and be a gentleman."
But Mrs. DeBose held us. Not only a Finch waiting on tables, but one in the courthouse lawing for niggers.
Jim stiffened. Mrs. DeBose's shot had gone home, and she knew it.
"Yes, indeed. What has this world come to when a Finch goes against his raising? I'll tell you."
She put her hand to her mouth. When she drew it away, it trailed a long silver thread of saliva.
"Your father's no better than the niggers and trash he works for."
Jim was scarlet. I pulled at his sleeve, and we were followed up the sidewalk by a philippic on our family's moral degeneration, the major premise of which was that half the Finches were in the asylum anyway, but if our mother were living, we would not have come to such a state. I wasn't sure what Jim resented most, but I took umbrage at Mrs. DeBose's assessment of the family's mental hygiene. I had become almost accustomed to hearing insults aimed at Atticus, but this was the first one coming from an adult. Except for her remarks about Atticus, Mrs. DeBose's attack was only routine. There was a hint of summer in the air. In the shadows it was cool, but the sun was warm, which meant good times coming. No school and dill. Jim bought his steam engine, and we went by Elmore's for my baton. Jim took no pleasure in his acquisition. He jammed it in his pocket and walked silently beside me toward home. On the way home, I nearly hit Mr. Link Dees, who said, "Look out now, Scout," when I missed a toss. And when we approached Mrs. DeBose's house, my baton was grimy from having picked it up out of the dirt so many times. She was not on the porch. In later years, I sometimes wondered exactly what made Jim do it. What made him break the bonds of, you just be a gentleman, son, and the phase of self-conscious rectitude he had recently entered. Jim had probably stood as much guff about Atticus lawing for niggers as had I, and I took it for granted that he kept his temper. He had a naturally tranquil disposition and a slow fuse. At the time, however, I thought the only explanation for what he did was that for a few minutes he simply went mad. What Jim did was something I'd do, as a matter of course, had I not been under Atticus's interdict, which I assumed included not fighting horrible old ladies. We had just come to her gate when Jim snatched my baton and ran flailing wildly up the steps into Mrs. DeBose's front yard, forgetting everything Atticus had said, forgetting that she packed a pistol under her shawls, forgetting that if Mrs. DeBose missed, her girl Jessie probably wouldn't. He did not begin to calm down until he had cut the tops off every camellia bush Mrs. DeBose owned, until the ground was littered with green buds and leaves. He bent my baton against his knee, snapped it in two, and threw it down. By that time, I was shrieking. Jim yanked my hair, said he didn't care, he'd do it again if he got a chance, and if I didn't shut up, he'd pull every hair out of my head. I didn't shut up, and he kicked me. I lost my balance and fell on my face. Jim picked me up roughly, but looked like he was sorry. There was nothing to say. We did not choose to meet Atticus coming home that evening. We skulked around the kitchen until Calpurnia threw us out. By some voodoo system, Calpurnia seemed to know all about it. She was a less than satisfactory source of palliation, but she did give Jim a hot biscuit and butter, which he tore in half and shared with me. It tasted like cotton. We went to the living room. I picked up a football magazine, found a picture of Dixie Howell, showed it to Jim, and said, "This looks like you." That was the nicest thing I could think to say to him, but it was no help. He sat by the windows, hunched down in a rocking chair, scowling, waiting. Daylight faded. 2 geological ages later, we heard the soles of Atticus's shoes scrape the front steps. The screen door slammed. There was a pause. Atticus was at the hat rack in the hall, and we heard him call, "Jim?" His voice was like the winter wind. Atticus switched on the ceiling light in the living room and found us there, frozen still. He carried my baton in one hand. Its filthy yellow tassel trailed on the rug. He held out his other hand. It contained fat camellia buds. "Jim," he said, "are you responsible for this?" "Yes, sir." "Why'd you do it?" Jim said softly, "She said you lawed for niggers and trash." "You did this because she said that?" Jim's lips moved, but his "yes, sir" was inaudible. "Son, I have no doubt that you've been annoyed by your contemporaries about me lawing for niggers, as you say. But to do something like this to a sick old lady is inexcusable. I strongly advise you to go down and have a talk with Mrs. DeBose," said Atticus. "Come straight home afterward." Jim did not move. "Go on," I said. I followed Jim out of the living room. "Come back here," Atticus said to me. I came back. Atticus picked up the mobile press and sat down in the rocking chair Jim had vacated. For the life of me, I did not understand how he could sit there in cold blood and read a newspaper when his only son stood an excellent chance of being murdered with a Confederate Army relic. Of course, Jim antagonized me sometimes until I could kill him. but when it came down to it, he was all I had. Atticus did not seem to realize this, or if he did, he didn't care. I hated him for that, but when you are in trouble, you become easily tired. Soon I was hiding in his lap, and his arms were around me.
"You're mighty big to be rocked," he said.
"You don't care what happens to him," I said. "You just send him on to get shot at when all he was doing was standing up for you." Atticus pushed my head under his chin.
"It's not time to worry yet," he said. "I never thought Jim would be the one to lose his head over this. Thought I'd have more trouble with you."
I said I didn't see why we had to keep our heads anyway, that nobody I knew at school had to keep his head about anything.
"Scout," said Atticus, "when summer comes, you'll have to keep your head about far worse things. It's not fair for you and Jim, I know that, but sometimes we have to make the best of things, and the way we conduct ourselves when the chips are down, well, all I can say is, when you and Jim are grown, maybe you'll look back on this with some compassion and some feeling that I didn't let you down. This case, Tom Robinson's case, is something that goes to the essence of a man's conscience. Scout, I couldn't go to church and worship God if I didn't try to help that man."
"Atticus, you must be wrong."
"How's that?"
"Well, most folks seem to think they're right and you're wrong."
"They're certainly entitled to think that, and they're entitled to full respect for their opinions," said Atticus. "But before I can live with other folks, I've got to live with myself. The one thing that doesn't abide by majority rule is a person's conscience."
When Jim returned, he found me still in Atticus's lap.
"Well, son," said Atticus.
He set me on my feet, and I made a secret reconnaissance of Jim. He seemed to be all in one piece, but he had a queer look on his face. Perhaps she had given him a dose of calomel. I cleaned it up for her and said I was sorry, but I ain't, and that I'd work on them every Saturday and try to make them grow back out. "There was no point in saying you were sorry if you aren't," said Atticus.
"Jim, she's old and ill. You can't hold her responsible for what she says and does. Of course, I'd rather she'd have said it to me than to either of you, but we can't always have our druthers."
Jim seemed fascinated by a rose in the carpet.
"Atticus," he said, "she wants me to read to her." "Read to her?"
"Yes, sir. She wants me to come every afternoon after school and Saturdays and read to her out loud for 2 hours. Atticus, do I have to?"
"Certainly."
"But she wants me to do it for a month."
"Then you'll do it for a month."
Jim planted his big toe delicately in the center of the rose and pressed it in. Finally, he said, "Atticus, it's all right on the sidewalk, but inside it's all dark and creepy. There's shadows and things on the ceiling." Atticus smiled grimly.
"That should appeal to your imagination. Just pretend you're inside the Radley house."
The following Monday afternoon, Jim and I climbed the steep front steps to Mrs. DeBose's house and padded down the open hallway. Jim, armed with Ivanhoe and full of superior knowledge, knocked at the second door on the left. "Mrs. DeBose," he called. Jesse opened the wood door and unlatched the screen door.
"Is that you, Jim Finch?" she said. "You got your sister with you?"
"I don't know."
"Let 'em both in, Jesse," said Mrs. DeBose.
Jesse admitted us and went off to the kitchen. An oppressive odor met us when we crossed the threshold. an odor I had met many times in rain-rotted gray houses where there are coal oil lamps, water dippers, and unbleached domestic sheets. It always made me afraid, expectant, watchful. In the corner of the room was a brass bed, and in the bed was Mrs. DeBose. I wondered if Jim's activities had put her there, and for a moment I felt sorry for her. She was lying under a pile of quilts and looked almost friendly. There was a marble-topped washstand by her bed. On it were a glass with a teaspoon in it, a red ear syringe, a box of absorbent cotton, and a steel alarm clock standing on three tiny legs. "So you brought that dirty little sister of yours, did you?" was her greeting. Jim said quietly, "My sister ain't dirty, and I ain't scared of you," although I noticed his knees shaking. I was expecting a tirade, but all she said was, "You may commence reading, Jeremy." Jim sat down in a cane-bottomed chair and opened Ivanhoe. I pulled up another one and sat beside him. "Come closer," said Mrs. DeBose. "Come to the side of the bed." We moved our chairs forward. This was the nearest I had ever been to her, and the thing I wanted most to do was move my chair back again. She was horrible. Her face was the color of a dirty pillowcase, and the corners of her mouth glistened with wet, which inched like a glacier down the deep grooves enclosing her chin. Old age liver spots dotted her cheeks, and her pale eyes had black pinpoint pupils. Her hands were knobby, and the cuticles were grown up over her fingernails. Her bottom plate was not in, and her upper lip protruded. From time to time she would draw her nether lip to her upper plate and carry her chin with it. This made the wet move faster. I didn't look any more than I had to. Jim reopened Ivanhoe and began reading. I tried to keep up with him, but he read too fast. When Jim came to a word he didn't know, he skipped it, but Mrs. DeBose would catch him and make him spell it out. Jim read for perhaps 20 minutes, during which time I looked at the soot-stained mantelpiece, out the window, anywhere to keep from looking at her. As he read along, I noticed that Mrs. DeBose's corrections grew fewer and farther between, that Jim had even left one sentence dangling in midair. She was not listening. I looked toward the bed. Something had happened to her. She lay on her back, with the quilts up to her chin. Only her head and shoulders were visible. Her head moved slowly from side to side. From time to time she would open her mouth wide, and I could see her tongue undulate faintly. Cords of saliva would collect on her lips. She would draw them in, then open her mouth again. Her mouth seemed to have a private existence of its own. It worked separate and apart from the rest of her, out and in, like a clam hole at low tide. Occasionally it would say, "Pfft," like some vicious substance coming to a boil. I pulled Jim's sleeve. He looked at me, then at the bed. Her head made its regular sweep toward us, and Jim said, "Mrs. DeBose, are you all right?" She did not hear him. The alarm clock went off and scared us stiff. A minute later, nerves still tingling, Jim and I were on the sidewalk headed for home. We did not run away. Jessie sent us. Before the clock wound down, she was in the room pushing Jim and me out of it. "Shoo," she said. "You all go home." Jim hesitated at the door. "It's time for her medicine," Jessie said. As the door swung shut behind us, I saw Jessie walking quickly toward Mrs. DeBose's bed. It was only 3:45 when we got home, so Jim and I drop-kicked in the backyard until it was time to meet Atticus. Atticus had 2 yellow pencils for me and a football magazine for Jim, which I suppose was a silent reward for our first day's session with Mrs. DeBose. Jim told him what happened.
"Did she frighten you?" asked Atticus.
"No, sir," said Jim. "But she's so nasty. She has fits or something. She spits a lot."
"She can't help that. When people are sick, they don't look nice sometimes."
"She scared me," I said.
Atticus looked at me over his glasses.
"You don't have to go with Jim, you know."
The next afternoon at Mrs. DeBose's was the same as the first, and so was the next, until gradually a pattern emerged. Everything would begin normally. That is, Mrs. DeBose would hound Jim for a while on her favorite subjects, her camellias and our father's nigger-loving propensities. She would grow increasingly silent, then go away from us. The alarm clock would ring, Jesse would shoo us out, and the rest of the day was ours.
"Atticus," I said one evening, "what exactly is a nigger lover?"
Atticus's face was grave.
"Has somebody been calling you that?"
"No, sir. Mrs. DeBose calls you that. She warms up every afternoon calling you that. Francis called me that last Christmas. That's where I first heard it."
"Is that the reason you jumped on him?" asked Atticus.
"Yes, sir."
"Then why are you asking me what it means?"
I tried to explain to Atticus that it wasn't so much what Francis said that had infuriated me as the way he had said it. It was like he'd said snot nose or something.
"Scout," said Atticus, "nigger lover is just one of those terms that don't mean anything, like snot nose. It's hard to explain. Ignorant, trashy people use it when they think somebody's favoring Negroes over and above themselves. It slipped into usage with some people like ourselves when they want a common, ugly term to label somebody."
"You aren't really a nigger lover, then, are you?"
"I certainly am. I do my best to love everybody. I'm hard put sometimes. Baby, it's never an insult to be called what somebody thinks is a bad name. It just shows you how poor that person is. It doesn't hurt you. So don't let Mrs. DeBose get you down. She has enough troubles of her own." One afternoon, a month later, Jim was plowing his way through Sir Walter Scout, as Jim called him, and Mrs. DeBose was correcting him at every turn when there was a knock on the door.
"Come in!" she screamed. Atticus came in. He went to the bed and took Mrs. DeBose's hand.
"I was coming from the office and didn't see the children," he said. "I thought they might still be here."
Mrs. DeBose smiled at him. For the life of me, I could not figure out how she could bring herself to speak to him when she seemed to hate him so.
"Do you know what time it is, Atticus?" she said. "Exactly 5:14. The alarm clock's set for 5:30. I want you to know that."
It suddenly came to me that each day we had been staying a little longer at Mrs. DeBose's, that the alarm clock went off a few minutes later every day, and that she was well into one of her fits by the time it sounded. Today she had antagonized Jim for nearly 2 hours with no intention of having a fit, and I felt hopelessly trapped. The alarm clock was the signal for our release. If one day it did not ring, what would we do?
"I have a feeling that Jim's reading days are numbered," said Atticus.
"Only a week longer, I think," she said, "just to make sure."
Jim rose,
but
Atticus put out his hand and Jim was silent. On the way home, Jim said he had to do it just for a month, and the month was up, and it wasn't fair.
"Just one more week, son," said Atticus.
"No," said Jim.
"Yes," said Atticus. The following week found us back at Mrs. DeBose's. The alarm clock had ceased sounding, but Mrs. DeBose would release us with, "That'll do." So late in the afternoon, Atticus would be home reading the paper when we returned. Although her fits had passed off, she was in every other way her old self. When Sir Walter Scott became involved in lengthy descriptions of moats and castles, Mrs. DeBose would become bored and pick on us. "Jeremy Fitch, I told you you'd live to regret tearing up my camellias. You regret it now, don't you?" Jim would say he certainly did. "Thought you could kill my snow on the mountain, did you? Well, Jesse says the top's growing back out. Next time you'll know how to do it right, won't you? You'll pull it up by the roots, won't you?" Jim would say he certainly would. "Don't you mutter at me, boy. You hold up your head and say, 'Yes, ma'am.' Don't guess you feel like holding it up, though, with your father what he is." Jim's chin would come up, and he would gaze at Mrs. DeBose with a face devoid of resentment. Through the weeks, he had cultivated an expression of polite and detached interest, which he would present to her in answer to her most blood-curdling inventions. At last the day came when Mrs. DeBose said, "That'll do." One afternoon, she added, "And that's all. Good day to you." It was over. We bounded down the sidewalk on a spree of sheer relief, leaping and howling. That spring was a good one. The days grew longer and gave us more playing time. Jim's mind was occupied mostly with the vital statistics of every college football player in the nation. Every night, Atticus would read us the sports pages of the newspapers. Alabama might go to the Rose Bowl again this year, judging from its prospects, not one of whose names we could pronounce. Atticus was in the middle of Wendy Seaton's column one evening when the telephone rang. He answered it, then went to the hat rack in the hall. "I'm going down to Mrs. DeBose's for a while," he said. "I won't be long." But Atticus stayed away until long past my bedtime. When he returned, he was carrying a candy box. Atticus sat down in the living room and put the box on the floor beside his chair. "What's she want?" asked Jim. We had not seen Mrs. DeBose for over a month. She was never on the porch anymore when we passed. "She's dead, son," said Atticus. "She died a few minutes ago." "Oh," said Jim. "Well." "Well is right," said Atticus. "She's not suffering anymore. She was sick for a long time." "Son, didn't you know what her fits were?" Jim shook his head. "Mrs. DeBose was a morphine addict," said Atticus. "She took it as a painkiller for years. The doctor put her on it. She'd have spent the rest of her life on it and died without so much agony, but she was too contrary." "Sir?" said Jim. Atticus said, "Just before your escapade, she called me to make her will. Dr. Reynolds told her she had only a few months left. Her business affairs were in perfect order, but she said, 'There's still one thing out of order.'" "What was that?" Jim was perplexed. "She said she was going to leave this world beholden to nothing and nobody. Jim, when you're sick as she was, it's all right to take anything to make it easier. But it wasn't all right for her. She said she meant to break herself of it before she died, and that's what she did." Jim said, "You mean that's what her fits were?" "Yes, that's what they were. Most of the time you were reading to her, I doubt if she heard a word you said. Her whole mind and body were concentrated on that alarm clock. If you hadn't fallen into her hands, I'd have made you go read to her anyway. It may have been some distraction. There was another reason." "Did she die free?" asked Jim. "As the mountain air," said Atticus. She was conscious to the last. Almost conscious, he smiled, and cantankerous. She still disapproved heartily of my doings and said I'd probably spend the rest of my life bailing you out of jail. She had Jesse fix you this box.
Atticus reached down and picked up the candy box. He handed it to Jim. Jim opened the box. Inside, surrounded by wads of damp cotton, was a white, waxy, perfect camellia. It was a snow on the mountain. Jim's eyes nearly popped out of his head. "Oh, hell devil! Oh, hell devil!" he screamed, flinging it down. "Why can't she leave me alone?" In a flash, Atticus was up and standing over him. Jim buried his face in Atticus's shirt front. "Shh," he said. "I think that was her way of telling you. Everything's all right now, Jim. Everything's all right. You know she was a great lady." "A lady?" Jim raised his head. His face was scarlet. "After all those things she said about you, a lady?"
"She was. She had her own views about things. A lot different from mine, maybe. Son, I told you that if you hadn't lost your head, I'd have made you go read to her. I wanted you to see something about her. I wanted you to see what real courage is, instead of getting the idea that courage is a man with a gun in his hand. It's when you know you're licked before you begin, but you begin anyway, and you see it through no matter what. You rarely win, but sometimes you do. Mrs. DeBose won. All 98 pounds of her. According to her views, she died beholden to nothing and nobody. She was the bravest person I ever knew." Jim picked up the candy box and threw it in the fire. He picked up the camellia, and when I went off to bed, I saw him fingering the wide petals. Atticus was reading the paper.
Part 2. 12. Jim was 12. He was difficult to live with, inconsistent, moody. His appetite was appalling, and he told me so many times to stop pestering him. I consulted Atticus. "Reckon he's got a tapeworm?" Atticus said no. Jim was growing. I must be patient with him and disturb him as little as possible. This change in Jim had come about in a matter of weeks. Mrs. DeBose was not cold in her grave. Jim had seemed grateful enough for my company when he went to read to her. Overnight, it seemed, Jim had acquired an alien set of values and was trying to impose them on me. Several times he went so far as to tell me what to do. After one altercation, when Jim hollered, "It's time you started being a girl and acting right," I burst into tears and fled to Calpurnia. "Don't you fret too much over Mr. Jim," she began. "Mr. Jim?" "Yeah, he's just about Mr. Jim now." "He ain't that old," I said. "All he needs is somebody to beat him up, and I ain't big enough." "Baby," said Calpurnia, "I just can't help it if Mr. Jim's growing up. He's gonna want to be off to himself a lot now, doing whatever boys do, so you just come right on in the kitchen when you feel lonesome. We'll find lots of things to do in here." The beginning of that summer boded well. Jim could do as he pleased. Calpurnia would do until Dill came. She seemed glad to see me when I appeared in the kitchen, and by watching her, I began to think there was some skill involved in being a girl. But summer came, and Dill was not there. I received a letter and a snapshot from him. The letter said he had a new father whose picture was enclosed, and he would have to stay in Meridian because they planned to build a fishing boat. His father was a lawyer like Atticus, only much younger. Dill's new father had a pleasant face, which made me glad Dill had captured him.
but I was crushed. Dill concluded by saying he would love me forever and not to worry. He would come get me and marry me as soon as he got enough money together, so please write. The fact that I had a permanent fiancé was little compensation for his absence. I had never thought about it, but summer was Dill by the fish pool smoking string. Dill's eyes, alive with complicated plans to make Boo Radley emerge. Summer was the swiftness with which Dill would reach up and kiss me when Jem was not looking. The longings we sometimes felt each other feel. With him, life was routine. Without him, life was unbearable. I stayed miserable for 2 days. As if that were not enough, the state legislature was called into emergency session, and Atticus left us for 2 weeks. The governor was eager to scrape a few barnacles off the ship of state. There were sit-down strikes in Birmingham. Bread lines in the cities grew longer. People in the country grew poorer. But these were events remote from the world of Jim and me. We were surprised one morning to see a cartoon in the Montgomery Advertiser above the caption, "Makem's Finch." It showed Atticus barefooted and in short pants, chained to a desk. He was diligently writing on a slate while some frivolous-looking girls yelled "Yoo-hoo!" at him. "That's a compliment," explained Jim. "He spends his time doing things that wouldn't get done if nobody did 'em." "Huh?" In addition to Jim's newly developed characteristics, he had acquired a maddening air of wisdom. "Oh, Scout, it's like reorganizing the tax systems of the counties and things. That kind of thing's pretty dry to most men." "How do you know?" "Oh, go on and leave me alone. I'm reading the paper." Jim got his wish. I departed for the kitchen. While she was shelling peas, Calpurnia suddenly said, "What am I going to do about y'all's church this Sunday?" "Nothing, I reckon. Atticus left us collection." Calpurnia's eyes narrowed, and I could tell what was going through her mind. "Cal," I said, "you know we'll behave. We haven't done anything in church in years." Calpurnia evidently remembered a rainy Sunday when we were both fatherless and teacherless. Left to its own devices, the class tied Eunice Ann Simpson to a chair and placed her in the furnace room. We forgot her, trooped upstairs to church, and were listening quietly to the sermon when a dreadful banging issued from the radiator pipes, persisting until someone investigated and brought forth Eunice Ann, saying she didn't want to play Shadrach anymore. Jim Finch said she wouldn't get burnt if she had enough faith, but it was hot down there. "Besides, Cal, this isn't the first time Atticus has left us," I protested. "Yeah, but he makes certain your teacher's going to be there." "I didn't hear him say this time. Reckon he forgot it." Calpurnia scratched her head. Suddenly she smiled. "How'd you and Mr. Jim like to come to church with me tomorrow?" "Really? How about it?" grinned Calpurnia. If Calpurnia had ever bathed me roughly before, it was nothing compared to her supervision of that Saturday night's routine. She made me soap all over twice, drew fresh water in the tub for each rinse. She stuck my head in the basin and washed it with Octagon soap and Castile. She had trusted Jim for years, but that night she invaded his privacy and provoked an outburst. "Can anybody take a bath in this house without the whole family looking?" Next morning she began earlier than usual to go over our clothes. When Calpurnia stayed overnight with us, she slept on a folding cot in the kitchen. That morning it was covered with our Sunday habiliments. She had put so much starch in my dress, it came up like a tent when I sat down. She made me wear a petticoat, and she wrapped a pink sash tightly around my waist.
She went over my patent leather shoes with a cold biscuit until she saw her face in them. "It's like we're going to Mardi Gras," said Jim. "What's all this for, Cal?" "I don't want anybody saying I don't look after my children," she muttered. "Mr. Jim, you absolutely can't wear that tie with that suit. It's green." "What's the matter with that?" "Suit's blue. Can't you tell?"
"Hee hee," I howled. "Jim's colorblind."
His face flushed angrily, but Calpurnia said, "Now you all quit that. You're gonna go to First Purchase with smiles on your faces." First Purchase African M.E. Church was in the quarters outside the southern town limits, across the old sawmill tracks. It was an ancient, paint-pilled frame building, the only church in Macomb with a steeple and bell, called First Purchase because it was paid for from the first earnings of freed slaves. Negroes worshipped in it on Sundays, and white men gambled in it on weekdays. The churchyard was brick-hard clay, as was the cemetery beside it. If someone died during a dry spell, the body was covered with chunks of ice until rain softened the earth. A few graves in the cemetery were marked with crumbling tombstones. Newer ones were outlined with brightly colored glass and broken Coca-Cola bottles. Lightning rods guarding some graves denoted dead who rested uneasily. Stumps of burned-out candles stood at the heads of infant graves. It was a happy cemetery. The warm, bittersweet smell of clean Negro welcomed us as we entered the churchyard. Hearts of Love hairdressing mingled with asafoetida, snuff, Hoyt's cologne, Brown's mule, peppermint, and lilac talcum. When they saw Jim and me with Calpurnia, the men stepped back and took off their hats. The women crossed their arms at their waists, weekday gestures of respectful attention. They parted and made a small pathway to the church door for us. Calpurnia walked between Jim and me, responding to the greetings of her brightly clad neighbors.
"What you up to, Miss Cal?" said a voice behind us.
Calpurnia's hands went to our shoulders, and we stopped and looked around. Standing in the path behind us was a tall Negro woman. Her weight was on one leg. She rested her left elbow in the curve of her hip, pointing at us with upturned palm. She was bullet-headed, with strange almond-shaped eyes, straight nose, and an Indian bow mouth. She seemed 7 feet high. I felt Calpurnia's hand dig into my shoulder.
"What you want, Lula?" she asked, in tones I had never heard her use. She spoke quietly, contemptuously.
"I wants to know why you bringin' white chillen to nigger church."
"They's my company," said Calpurnia.
Again, I thought her voice strange. She was talking like the rest of them.
"Yeah, and I reckon you's company at the Finch House during the week."
A murmur ran through the crowd. "Don't you fret," Calpurnia whispered to me, but the roses on her hat trembled indignantly. When Lula came up the pathway toward us, Calpurnia said, "Stop right there, nigger." Lula stopped, but she said, "You ain't got no business bringing white chillen here. They got their church, we got iron. It is our church, ain't it, Miss Cal?" Calpurnia said, "It's the same God, ain't it?"
Jim said, "Let's go home, Cal. They don't want us here."
I agreed. They did not want us here. I sensed, rather than saw, that we were being advanced upon. They seemed to be drawing closer to us, but when I looked up at Calpurnia, there was amusement in her eyes. When I looked down the pathway again, Lula was gone. In her place was a solid mass of colored people. One of them stepped from the crowd. It was Zebo, the garbage collector.
"Mr. Jim," he said,
We're mighty glad to have you all here. Don't pay no attention to Lula. She's contentious because Reverend Sykes threatened to church her. She is a troublemaker from way back, got fancy ideas and haughty ways. We're mighty glad to have you all. With that, Calpurnia led us to the church door, where we were greeted by Reverend Sykes, who led us to the front pew. First Purchase was unsealed and unpainted within. Along its walls, unlighted kerosene lamps hung on brass brackets. Pine benches served as pews. Behind the rough oak pulpit, a faded pink silk banner proclaimed God is love, the church's only decoration except a rotogravure print of Hunt's The Light of the World. There was no sign of piano, organ, hymn books, church programs, the familiar ecclesiastical impedimenta we saw every Sunday. It was dim inside, with a damp coolness slowly dispelled by the gathering congregation. At each seat was a cheap cardboard fan bearing a garish Garden of Gethsemane, courtesy Tyndall's Hardware Company. You name it, we sell it. Calpurnia motioned Jim and me to the end of the row and placed herself between us. She fished in her purse, drew out her handkerchief, and untied the hard wad of change in its corner. She gave a dime to me and a dime to Jim. We've got ours, he whispered. You keep it, Calpurnia said. You're my company. Jim's face showed brief indecision on the ethics of withholding his own dime, but his innate courtesy won, and he shifted his dime to his pocket. I did likewise, with no qualms. Cal, I whispered, where are the hymn books? We don't have any, she said. Well, how? Shh, she said. Reverend Sykes was standing behind the pulpit, staring the congregation to silence. He was a short, stocky man in a black suit, black tie, white shirt, and a gold watch chain that glinted in the light from the frosted windows. He said, "Brethren and sisters, we are particularly glad to have company with us this morning. Mr. and Miss Finch, you all know their father. Before I begin, I will read some announcements." Reverend Sykes shuffled some papers, chose one, and held it at arm's length. "The Missionary Society meets in the home of Sister Annette Reeves next Tuesday. Bring your sewing." He read from another paper. "You all know of Brother Tom Robinson's trouble. He has been a faithful member of First Purchase since he was a boy. The collection taken up today and for the next 3 Sundays will go to Helen, his wife, to help her out at home." I punched Jim. "That's the Tom Atticus, the..." "Shh!" I turned to Calpurnia, but was hushed before I opened my mouth. Subdued, I fixed my attention upon Reverend Sykes, who seemed to be waiting for me to settle down. "Will the music superintendent lead us in the first hymn?" he said. Zebo rose from his pew and walked down the center aisle, stopping in front of us and facing the congregation. He was carrying a battered hymn book. He opened it and said, "We'll sing number 273. This was too much for me. "How are you going to sing it if there ain't any hymn books?" Calpurnia smiled. "Hush, baby," she whispered. "You'll see in a minute." Zebo cleared his throat and read in a voice like the rumble of distant artillery. "There's a land beyond the river." Miraculously on pitch, 100 voices sang out Zebo's words. The last syllable, held to a husky hum, was followed by Zebo saying, "That we call the sweet forever." Music again swelled around us. The last note lingered,
and Zebo met it with the next line, "And we only reached that shore by fate's decree." The congregation hesitated. Zebo repeated the line carefully, and it was sung. At the chorus, Zebo closed the book, a signal for the congregation to proceed without his help. On the dying notes of Jubilee, Zebo said, "In that far-off sweet forever, just beyond the shining river." Line for line, voices followed in simple harmony until the hymn ended in a melancholy murmur. I looked at Jim, who was looking at Zebo from the corners of his eyes. I didn't believe it either, but we had both heard it. Reverend Sykes then called on the Lord to bless the sick and the suffering, a procedure no different from our church practice, except Reverend Sykes directed the deity's attention to several specific cases. His sermon was a forthright denunciation of sin, an austere declaration of the motto on the wall behind him. He warned his flock against the evils of heady brews, gambling, and strange women. Bootleggers caused enough trouble in the quarters, but women were worse. Again, as I had often met it in my own church, I was confronted with the impurity of women doctrine that seemed to preoccupy all clergymen. Jim and I had heard the same sermon Sunday after Sunday, with only one exception. Reverend Sykes used his pulpit more freely to express his views on individual lapses from grace. Jim Hardy had been absent from church for 5 Sundays, and he wasn't sick. Constance Jackson had better watch her ways. She was in grave danger for quarreling with her neighbors. She had erected the only spite fence in the history of the quarters. Reverend Sykes closed his sermon. He stood beside a table in front of the pulpit and requested the morning offering, a proceeding that was strange to Jim and me. One by one, the congregation came forward and dropped nickels and dimes into a black enameled coffee can. Jim and I followed suit and received a soft, thank you, as our dimes clinked. To our amazement, Reverend Sykes emptied the can onto the table and raked the coins into his hand. He straightened up and said, "This is not enough. We must have $10. The congregation stirred. "You all know what it's for. Helen can't leave those children to work while Tom's in jail. If everybody gives one more dime, we'll have it." Reverend Sykes waved his hand and called someone in the back of the church. "Alec, shut the doors. Nobody leaves here till we have $10. Calpurnia scratched in her handbag and brought forth a battered leather coin purse. "Now, Cal," Jim whispered when she handed him a shiny quarter, "we can put ours in. Give me your dime, Scout." The church was becoming stuffy, and it occurred to me that Reverend Sykes intended to sweat the amount due out of his flock. Fans crackled, feet shuffled, tobacco chewers were in agony. Reverend Sykes startled me by saying sternly, "Carlo Richardson, I haven't seen you up this aisle yet." A thin man in khaki pants came up the aisle and deposited a coin. The congregation murmured approval. Reverend Sykes then said, "I want all of you with no children to make a sacrifice and give one more dime apiece. Then we'll have it." Slowly, painfully, the $10 was collected. The door was opened, and the gust of warm air revived us. Zebo lined on Jordan's stormy banks, and church was over. I wanted to stay and explore, but Calpurnia propelled me up the aisle ahead of her.
At the church door, while she paused to talk with Zebo and his family, Jim and I chatted with Reverend Sykes. I was bursting with questions, but decided I would wait and let Calpurnia answer them. "We were specially glad to have you all here," said Reverend Sykes. "This church has no better friend than your daddy." My curiosity burst. "Why were you all taking up collection for Tom Robinson's wife?"
"Didn't you hear why?" asked Reverend Sykes. "Helen's got 3 little ones, and she can't go out to work."
"Why can't she take them with her, Reverend?" I asked. It was customary for field Negroes with tiny children to deposit them in whatever shade there was while their parents worked. Usually the baby sat in the shade between 2 rows of cotton. Those unable to sit were strapped papoose style on their mother's backs or resided in extra cotton bags. Reverend Sykes hesitated. "To tell you the truth, Miss Jean Louise, Helen's finding it hard to get work these days. When it's picking time, I think Mr. Link Dees'll take her."
"Why not, Reverend?"
Before he could answer, I felt Calpurnia's hand on my shoulder. At its pressure, I said, "We thank you for letting us come." Jim echoed me, and we made our way homeward. "Cal, I know Tom Robinson's in jail, and he's done something awful, but why won't folks hire Helen?" I asked. Calpurnia, in her navy voile dress and tub of a hat, walked between Jim and me. "It's because of what folks say Tom's done," she said. "Folks aren't anxious to have anything to do with any of his family."
"Just what did he do, Cal?"
Calpurnia sighed. "Old Mr. Bob Ewell accused him of raping his girl and had him arrested and put in jail."
"Mr. Ewell?"
My memory stirred.
"Does he have anything to do with those Ewells that come every first day of school and then go home? Why, Atticus said they were absolute trash. I never heard Atticus talk about folks the way he talked about the Ewells. He said..."
"Yeah, those are the ones."
"Well, if everybody in Macomb knows what kind of folks the Ewells are, they'd be glad to hire Helen."
"What's rape, Cal?" "It's something you'll have to ask Mr. Finch about," she said. "He can explain it better than I can. You all hungry? The Reverend took a long time unwinding this morning. He's not usually so tedious."
"He's just like our preacher," said Jim.
"But why do you all sing hymns that way?"
"Lining?" she asked. "Is that what it is?"
"Yeah, it's called lining. They've done it that way as long as I can remember."
"Jim said it looked like they could save the collection money for a year and get some hymn books."
Calpurnia laughed. "Wouldn't do any good," she said. "They can't read."
"Can't read?" I asked. "All those folks?"
"That's right," Calpurnia nodded.
"Can't but about 4 folks in First Purchase read. I'm one of them."
"Where'd you go to school, Cal?" asked Jim.
"Nowhere. Let's see now. Who taught me my letters? It was Miss Maudie Atkinson's aunt, old Miss Buford."
"Are you that old?"
"I'm older than Mr. Finch, even," Calpurnia grinned. "Not sure how much, though. We started remembering one time, trying to figure out how old I was. I can remember back just a few years more than he can, so I'm not much older, when you take off the fact that men can't remember as well as women."
"What's your birthday, Cal?"
"I just have it on Christmas. It's easier to remember that way. I don't have a real birthday."
"But Cal," Jim protested, "you don't look even near as old as Atticus."
"Colored folks don't show their ages so fast," she said. "Maybe because they can't read. Cal, did you teach Zebo?"
"Yeah, Mr. Jim. There wasn't a school even when he was a boy. I made him learn, though."
Zebo was Calpurnia's eldest son. If I had ever thought about it, I would have known that Calpurnia was of mature years. Zebo had half-grown children, but then I had never thought about it.
Did you teach him out of a primer, like us? I asked. No, I made him get a page of the Bible every day, and there was a book Miss Buford taught me out of. Bet you don't know where I got it, she said. We didn't know. Calpurnia said, Your granddaddy Finch gave it to me. Were you from the landing? Jim asked. You never told us that. I certainly am, Mr. Jim. Grew up down there between the Buford place and the landing. I spent all my days working for the Finches or the Bufords, and I moved to Macon when your daddy and your mama married. What was the book, Cal? I asked. Blackstone's Commentaries. Jim was thunderstruck. You mean you taught Zebo out of that? Why, yes, sir, Mr. Jim. Calpurnia timidly put her fingers to her mouth. They were the only books I had. Your granddaddy said Mr. Blackstone wrote fine English. That's why you don't talk like the rest of them, said Jim. The rest of who? Rest of the colored folks. Cal, but you talk like they did in church. That Calpurnia led a modest double life never dawned on me. The idea that she had a separate existence outside our household was a novel one, to say nothing of her having command of two languages. Cal, I asked, why do you talk nigger talk to your folks when you know it's not right? Well, in the first place, I'm black. That doesn't mean you have to talk that way when you know better, said Jim. Calpurnia tilted her hat and scratched her head, then pressed her hat down carefully over her ears. It's right hard to say, she said. Suppose you and Scout talked colored folks' talk at home. It'd be out of place, wouldn't it? Now what if I talked white folks' talk at church and with my neighbors? They'd think I was putting on airs to beat Moses. But, Cal, you know better, I said. It's not necessary to tell all you know. It's not ladylike in the second place. Folks don't like to have somebody around knowing more than they do. It aggravates them. You're not going to change any of them by talking right. They've got to want to learn themselves. And when they don't want to learn, there's nothing you can do but keep your mouth shut or talk their language. Cal, can I come to see you sometimes? She looked down at me. See me, honey? You see me every day. Out to your house, I said. Sometimes after work. Atticus can get me. Anytime you want to, she said. We'd be glad to have you. We were on the sidewalk by the Radley place. Look on the porch yonder, Jim said. I looked over to the Radley place, expecting to see its phantom occupant sunning himself in the swing. The swing was empty. I mean our porch, said Jim. I looked down the street. An armored, upright, uncompromising Aunt Alexandra was sitting in a rocking chair, exactly as if she had sat there every day of her life.